GB.
Giles Brown.
Creo que sí.
Wright Brothers' Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Manned Flight. This book is the first deconstruction of the Wright Brothers' myth. Yes, a myth, I said. They were not, as we've all come to believe, two halves of the same apple. Each had a distinctive role in creating the first flying machine. How could two brothers who never left home, were high school dropouts, and made a living as bicycle mechanics, have figured out the secret of manned flight? This new history of the Wright Brothers' monumental accomplishments focuses on the early years of trial and error at Kitty Hawk. And here to tell us all about it is the author of Wright Brothers' Wrong Story, William Hazelgrove. Good morning to you, I suppose, William. Where are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm in Chicago, talking to you from Chicago.
What a fabulous place to be. So, tell us a little bit about then. So, have we got this all wrong then? Is the story of the Wright brothers, we've always believed that it's Orville's is the guy who came up with the original plan and flew the plane. What was the actual background behind the Wright brothers?
Well, you know, it's called the Wright myth, basically, and it's been propagated all the way down to David McCullough's book that came out in 2015. And as you said, it says, in fact, they were these 50% partners, that they were the same. But the truth is that Wilbur Wright is the man who invented this airplane. And they came from this very insulated family where the bishop was his overbearing father. Here's a couple of things for your listeners to know. They dropped out of high school. They never married. They were this sort of misanthropic family that was very isolated from the world. And basically, Bishop Wright said to them, the world is evil, and so you can't tell them, you know, really what's going on. And so this whole 50% myth began then. But the truth is that Wilbur Wright, after he went into a three-year depression, which, by the way, was caused by a future mass murderer who shattered his jaw, he goes into a three-year depression and becomes obsessed with flight. And that is where it begins. And then he contacts the Smithsonian and asks for all this data from them, you know, on his own. And then he contacts a man named Octave Chanutin, aeronautical scientist. And they work out the head-cracking physics of flight that nobody else had done before with a 500-letter correspondence. So it wasn't he and his brother. It's he and this Octave Chanute. And then Wilbur goes down to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, alone in 1900. And this is actually the beginning of these experiments that would lead to the famous flight in 1903.
I mean, could you just, were you able to then, at that time, because forgive me, because I'm not up to speed on the Smithsonian, but presumably, were you allowed to say to write to the Smithsonian and say, send me everything you've got on aeronautical flying ideas?
Yes, well, and think about how crazy this was. He's a bike mechanic. Yeah. He has no training at all, and he asks him, and so they send him these pamphlets, but he takes those. Now, Wilbur had a theory, and that was that if you could study birds, you could learn flight. Well, he figured out that birds flex their wings. They call this wing warping, right? So it becomes ailerons. He took an inner tube box, and he would flex it to see if this worked. Well, so then he builds a kite on his own, and he takes that down to Kitty Hawk, and he flies this thing and makes the wings warp in turn. So this is the beginning of flight. Again, he's doing this all by himself with absolutely no training at all. I mean, he was a genius. He was an engineering genius with absolutely no training. And from there, he starts to do these series of experiments where he actually gets into a glider down there in Kitty Hawk, which is, by the way, to your listeners, the ends of the earth in 1900. This is just this little outpost in the middle of nowhere. And he actually goes off these cliffs, catches the wind, and he actually starts to fly at that point.
What was Orville doing at this time then?
Great question. Orville finally joins him down there. Now, Orville is sort of today we would call him like a metrosexual. He's very concerned about his appearance. He's a gifted mechanic. But he's not, doesn't have this tinge of genius. So he assists him. You know, Wilbur will say, let's do this or that. But it's an assistant role. Now, Orville, here's where the Wright myth really begins. Wilbur will die in 1912 from typhoid fever. Orville will live to 1948. Okay, so they fly in 1903, December 17th, the famous flight. Wilbur dies. Well, Orville then has a biography written in 1942 by a man named Fred Kelly. And Fred Kelly that Orville says, you can write this, but I'm going to approve every page that you write. So what is this biography? It changes history. It says, basically, that these two brothers were the same. And in this, there's a huge fight with the Smithsonian going on. Now, and just not going into too deeply, but basically what happens is the Smithsonian says, you were not the first to fly. Okay, our man Samuel Langley, secretary of the Smithsonian, actually invented the plane first.
Right.
Orville says, no, this is not true. And he actually says to him, if you persist with this, I'm going to ship the plane over to Britain. Well, they do, and he ships the plane to Britain in 1928, where it stays for 20 years. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Charles Lindbergh, all these guys try and get him to bring it back. He says, no, not until the Smithsonian admits that they lied about this plane.
Interesting. But presumably Wilbur would be taking, as any good scientist you would hope, or any good inventor, would be taking copious notes of where he, and you know, where he was going right, where he was going wrong. I mean, tremendous risk he had just to throw himself off cliffs with the glider. And what happened to the gentleman whose name you mentioned earlier on in our interview?
Octave Chanute.
That's the one.
Yes, right. Okay, so Octave Chanute, and he... have been working this out, and you know, here's what happens. Actually, is Wilbur is invited to the Western Society of Engineers to present his findings, which he does, and this becomes sort of a Bible of aeronautics, and this is at the invitation of Chanute. So this bike mechanic, you know, already scientists are recognizing. Okay, so after the flight, Chanute, you know, starts, who you know, at this point has been working with Wilbur, but the pupil is starting to eclipse the mentor. One thing that Wilbur did, and this is really the smoking gun of all this, is that Wilbur realized all the lift coefficients were wrong. Okay, and that is basically, if you put your hand outside of a car window when you're driving, your hand will be forced up. That's lift, okay?
Yeah.
So he figures out all these lift coefficients that everybody's been working with are wrong. So he builds the first wind tunnel, and he figures out the correct lift coefficients, and he sends them to Octave Chanute, who says, wow, you know, you're beyond me at this point. Okay, so he makes those adjustments. His plane actually now can fly in a correct way. So he's totally rewritten aviation. And by the way, Wilbur Wright's patent is not for the first airplane. It's for the first control system, aileron, rudder, elevator, that's used in every jetliner today. So after the plane flies, Octave Chanute says, hey, I taught him everything that he knows. And Wilbur said, absolutely not. You did not teach me everything. I figured this out on my own. And they split. Octave Chanute dies at a point. So it's a, sort of a sad legacy there because, you know, the man who actually got him going and who, you know, they worked out the head-cracking physics of flight together. They never spoke to each other again.
And so, if Orville is saying that he was a partner along with his brother and was just as brilliant as his brother, were there any other contemporaries around taking notes and saying, "Well, hang on a second, I remember that you know, Wilbur was the one doing most of the work, and you were basically, you know, waxing your moustache and checking yourself in the mirror."
Yes. Well, you know, really one reason people thought Orville actually flew first was because there's a famous photo. All right, when they flew on December 17th, 1903, it's about 25 degrees, 34 mile an hour wind, a picture was taken by a camera, and they didn't even know this existed. And this picture shows the plane lifting off only for 12 seconds. Only 12 seconds. It was a controlled crash. But Orville's flying it. They did a coin toss. Orville won. Orville flies it. Wilbur flies after that for a full minute. Okay, a full minute. Now, that's really the first controlled flight. But the picture that is developed in Dayton, Ohio, shows Orville. So right there, it's skewed. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Nobody believed them. After the 1903 flight, nobody believed the Wright brothers had flown. The United States government doesn't believe them because they gave the Smithsonian $50,000 to build a plane and it couldn't fly. So what did they do? They actually, you know, developed another plane and went to Europe. And in France, Wilbur flew, and he flew figure eight. People in Europe could not believe this. They could not believe this man was flying figure eights. He flew royalty, he flew all these people, and it was the French, actually, the French army, that bought their first plane. And that's actually how they started to get money, finally. The United States simply didn't believe them. They had headlines like flyers or liars. So it took about, you know, 5 years for them to prove to the world what they had done, or what Wilbur had done, actually.
But then that's more than a little ironic when you consider how the brothers, it's woven into American folklore, these two all-American boys, these brothers working hand in hand, you know, put America first, excuse me, but put America right. first, and then go on, you know, to start the you know, they are the full founders of modern aviation.
Right. Well, you know, America loves teamwork. You know, Americans like to believe everybody's equal and we can all do this together. It simply doesn't make sense. First of all, every modern breakthrough, every great symphony, every great novel, every great song is the work of one person with one vision. So when this sort of, you know, bogus biography by Fred Kelly was published saying, oh, they were these 50% partners, and by the way, in the biography, Orville's name appears 600 times and Wilbur's only appears 300, you know, people glommed on to this. It's hard to believe that one man had this vision. Here's what's interesting about Wilbur. He took a lot of existing technology, and he, you know, he had several theories that set him out from the pack. One is he believed that flight was inherently unstable. Everybody else believed flight was stable. In other words, it was like a locomotive going down a track. You pointed the plane, and it would go. Wilbur said, no, flight is inherently unstable, and you have to control it. That's why he developed this system of control. And so, you know, this is a man who saw, as his raison d'etre, his reason for living, was really to solve this problem of flight with absolutely no background at all. You know, this is like, you know, from Mozart to Henry Ford to, you know, whoever. It's one man's vision that is out allows human beings to move forward. It's not a collective, 9 times out of 10.
I mean, how did Orville then live with himself? Or did he find it quite easy to live with himself after Wilbur's death in, what was it, 1913, you said, from disease? How did he just sort of literally spend the rest of his life surfing on the coattails and surfing on the reputation that his brother had really built up?
Well, actually, what he did was, he got in a fight with the Smithsonian, but he then sold interest in the plane company that they had created. And he never really flew again. And so, you know, he was sort of this tinkering inventor, and he actually had a girlfriend that nobody knew about. Her name was Mabel Beck, his secretary, who this was revealed later, because, you know, the whole myth of the Wright brothers was they were almost sexless. They never had relationships with anybody, and they did live at home their whole life. So Wilbur, you know, built himself a mansion. He actually was the one, you know, he was a millionaire. And, you know, so he sort of lived in this, in the glory of the Wright brothers. But you're absolutely right in that, you know, this canard that he, you know, because of that picture, he, in fact, was the one who invented flight, you know, was pushed forward. And he rode that all the way to 1948 when he died. Now, what's interesting is that plane that he shipped to London, the 1903 Flyer, that was in the Battle of Britain. It was, you know, being bombed by the Germans during, you know, the Battle of Britain. So they had to actually move that out to Covington and put it, you know, underground. And that didn't come back. The plane did not come back to the United States until 1948, after Orville had died. And they finally put it into the Smithsonian, after the Smithsonian admitted they were wrong, and pushed, you know, Charles Lindbergh's plane back and put it front and center there. So, you know, he sort of lived this life of the landed sort of inventor. But the truth is, his brother, who died in 1912, was that brilliant spark that produced flight.
So why did you decide the time was right to go after this? And how did you go after deconstructing one of the great myths of American aviation heritage?
I'd read David McCullough's book. And by the way, he's a great writer. I enjoy a lot of his books. But I'm from Virginia, so I went to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, as a kid on vacation every summer. So I was fascinated with it. But when I read David McCullough's book, it left me cold, because I thought, here are these sawdust characters, these guys in derbies and, you know, ties and vests, and, you know, the myth was they just ran down to Kitty Hawk and invented flight. I was like, this is not true. You know, these are living, breathing people. You know, I wrote a book called Madam President, where the first woman president of the United States was actually in 1919 to 1921, was Edith Wilson. Now, so you know, what I like to do is go, well, what's the real story? And so actually, I started out just to want to write a book about the personal lives of the Wright brothers, you know, Did they date? What was really going on? And then all of a sudden I stumbled into, after reading the papers of Wilbur and Orville, which are about 2 feet tall, I realized that Wilbur Wright was the man who invented flight. And so I called my publisher and said, look, I got to change this book. This is the real story here. This is the unknown story. And, you know, the Daily Mail broke it in Britain, you know, with a great article. And, you know, I've got lots of reactions.
And so how did you actually get the information in? How did you get did you get private papers? Were there journals kept? How did you find out this? Because, as you said, it's been a myth.
Right. Well, what I did was I requested, the Smithsonian has all the papers of Wilbur and Orville Wright, and I found out that they were actually bound in the 1950s. So I got hold of those. You know, I scoured the internet, found them, got them shipped to me. And like I said, each one's about, almost a foot tall. So these two monster books of just letters and diaries. And so I just start to read through them. You know, the best thing you can do whenever you do this kind of research is to get letters, because people reveal themselves in letters. You know, again, Bishop Wright, who, you know, said to the world, oh, they did this together. Well, he wrote a letter to Wilbur Wright saying, hey, look, you have to be careful. Without you, Orville's nothing. He's nothing. You were it. So, I mean, you know, you see people's inner thoughts, and then you start to construct this story. And then when I started to read about Fred Kelly, he was just this writer who was trying to get this book published and working with Orville, and Orville said, well, I got to approve every page. And suddenly you realize, oh, this whole first biography was a sham. Well, that first biography became the Bible that every historian since has used to write about the Wright brothers, you know, all the way up to David McCullough. And so, you know, so there was this sort of original sin that started back then that, you know, you have to work your way forward. So I said, well, I'm going to start from scratch. I'm basically going to start over and see and say what I think happened back in 1903.
You see, normally when I speak to people who write these books, and especially when it's historical, you know, characters from history like this, I always ask them, you know, is there a eureka moment where you find something about the figure that nails them and you think, right, I've got your personality? But with a book like this, pretty much all of it must have been a eureka moment, because we have been fed the fact that, you know, Wilbur and Orville Wright were the brothers working together, arm in arm, singing a happy song and putting the plane up in the air.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think for me was after Wilbur, you know, I'm a writer, so, you know, I sort of know what, you know, writers go through. And after, and artists in general, I mean, because Wilbur was sort of like an artist without a calling. And when he was 17 and he got his jaw smashed by this, you know, future serial killer in Dayton, Ohio.
Who was the future serial killer, by the way? Because you said that twice. So
Oliver Crook Haw is right. His name. And he was like this man boy who was hopped up on cocaine tooth drops and drugs and everything. And so he sees the bishop's kid coming to him while they're playing hockey, raises his stick and smashes Wilbur's jaw. And so Wilbur then goes into this, you know, 3 to 4 year depression. While his mother's dying, he starts caring for her. He doesn't leave the house. So he goes into sort of, you know, Joseph Conrad's Dark Night of the Soul. And he comes upon Otto Lilienthal, who's, you know, jumping off cliffs in Germany, and they call him the Birdman. And, you know, and he's getting all this press because he puts his wings on his back. He jumps off cliffs, kicks his legs left and right to turn. And he starts to follow him. And it possesses him. Flight possesses him. And then when Lilienthal kills himself, you know, flying because of a downdraft, breaks his neck, Lilienthal says, you know, it's worth it. It's worth it to risk your life, and somebody has to pick this up. And Wilbur picks up. And that was sort of a eureka moment for me. It was like, you know, this became his mission in life. And once that happens to you, you're gripped by it. And you have no choice. You know, I have a theory that you have to follow your talent. You have responsibility to your talent wherever it takes you. And I think that's what Wilbur did. He found out he had this unique talent to take this vision and this God-given ability to work out head-cracking physics for, you know, lift coefficients and all these things. And he could be the one to solve the problem of human flight.
You talk about people following their God-given gifts. You know, you have done this sort of thing before. What's your next, just looking at the list of novels that you've written, what's your next project going to be then, after, obviously, Wright Brothers' Wrong Story?
Okay, I've got actually a book coming out on the woman who danced at the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago, which was in the worst year of the Great Depression, and they had absolutely no money, and this woman named Sally Rand danced there, and she became the number one financial draw and actually made this whole fair profitable, this hillbilly from the Ozarks in the worst year of the Great Depression, and would actually go on to just change women's sexuality all over the world.
The book is called Wright Brothers Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Manned Flight. It's out now. It's on Prometheus Books. It's by William Hazelgrave. William, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there a website? I presumably you do the sort of social media thing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can go to williamhazelgrove.com. You can just put in the name of the book. You can put in my name. The Wright Brothers Wrong Story, William Hazelgrove, you'll go right to it, and you can go there. It's all over the place. It's in Barnes & Noble and all over Amazon, all over the net.
I just love the way you say it. It's all over the place. Yeah, absolutely. Only one more question I have to ask you, because it's something you mentioned right at the beginning of the interview, William, about Kitty Hawk. Is it still the end of the world?
It's been built up somewhat. You know, people go there to vacation. But I will say this. Wilbur loved Kitty Hawk. Why? Because it was his laboratory. When he went there, you know, he had total isolation. That's what you need to create, right? And still when you go there and you say you're on your cottage and you go down to the beach, you know, you do still have that feeling of being away from everything. And because Kitty Hawk's actually an island, so it's the Outer Banks of the United States. So, you know, it still has that strange thing, and he believed that Kitty Hawk cured all ills, that it made him more physically healthy.
The book is called Wright Brothers Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Manned Flight. It's by William Hazelgrove. William, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this afternoon.
Oh, thank you very much.
Talk Radio Europe.